Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for coming out on this very warm June afternoon to support the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and to support each other, yourselves, and you. Today I wanted to talk about a small passage from this book, Saying Yes to Life, which I worked on with Ezra Beda. Ezra Beda is in the Ordinary Mind School of Zen, which is a school that has a lot in common with ours. Good fortune is arbitrary, and certainly nothing we can rely on. Yet we still cling to the belief that it's our right that things always go our way. Perhaps it's the belief that we shouldn't have any problems, any discomfort, any pain, that makes life seem so distressing. Life doesn't match our image of how it should be, and we conclude life itself is wrong. We relate to everything from the narrow, fearful perspective of I want, and what we want is to feel good. When our emotional distress does not feel good, we recoil from it. The resulting discomfort generates fear, and fear creates even more distress, and distress becomes our enemy, something to be rid of. Let us instead examine our basic requirement that life should be comfortable. This one assumption causes all of us endless difficulties. I think that this passage and this perspective seems very almost off-putting, negative or something, but I think it is really quite akin to the five remembrances in which we remind ourselves that we are of the nature of sickness, old age, death, loss, change. These can also seem like major downers, but actually they're very liberating. They're empowering, they're reminders. They're there for us. When we do encounter difficulties, we can recall, yes, this is that thing. This is that suffering. This is that distress that I know is the nature of life. This teaching that this reminder that we think things should go our way. We think life should treat us fairly. We think that people should do their jobs. We think that our teachers should never fail us. And all of the arising of these beliefs is completely natural, completely human. The absence of those beliefs would the absence of those beliefs ever arising would lead to probably a very strange life indeed. But the place where Zen invites us to look is with those beliefs having arisen, recognizing that they are beliefs. We have a belief that our life should feel comfortable. And then when it doesn't, we feel like we have no recourse because we or life has failed. But I think Zen practice holds up a very powerful alternative in recognizing and really examining those beliefs, that one belief, the belief, or any of a kind of cluster of beliefs, a belief in fairness, a belief in comfort. Life doesn't match our image of how it should be, and we conclude life itself is wrong. And anytime we hear ourselves inwardly using this word should, or inwardly or outwardly using the words I hate or I need, part of the invitation of Zen practice is to not just act out should or need or hate, but to notice their presence, and even in the presence of those things arising, to reconnect or remain connected to a awareness of the fullness and enoughness and can't be otherwise-ness of things as they are. Sometimes this means remaining uncomfortably with this dissonance, remaining uncomfortably with the tension of our mind against life, remaining uncomfortably with all of the imperfections of this perfect world. And this doesn't mean that we don't take action. It doesn't mean that we just passively, let people walk all over us, or that we sit idly by as evils, big or small, are manifesting in the world. But the challenge is to respond freely, to respond inclusively, to do what needs doing for the self-validating value of doing, and not because we need things to be otherwise, or we need people to be otherwise, or we need life to be otherwise. But this is so compelling, isn't it? This wish for things to go our way. I remember when I was working on this book with Ezra, and I was working and we were working on this section that says good fortune is arbitrary and certainly nothing we can rely on. Yet we still cling to the belief that it's our right that things go our way. I was really kind of like startled, kind of taken aback. To realize that in a way, yes, good fortune is totally arbitrary. But we think that it's controllable. And this is something that we see in our zazen. So you do zazen, and at some point or other you may experience, and if you do it for enough periods, eventually it'll happen that you experience some kind of spaciousness, some kind of calmness, some kind of settledness. And then, because that happens once in a while, because that happens sometimes, we think that that is good zazen, and we try to make that happen all the time. And the problem, the challenge comes not because we can't succeed at all, but because we can succeed a little bit. And because we can succeed a little bit, we think that if only we were better, stronger, faster, we could succeed more, or maybe all the time. And the same thing happens with good fortune. Because some things actually sometimes do work out for us. We want that to be the baseline and perpetual state of affairs. That this practice is about being able to equanimously encounter calm mind, agitated mind, spacious mind, painful life, things going our way, things not going our way. An important part of practicing this equanimity is actually to practice it with the good stuff too. We think that maybe we can get away with just grasping after the good things that we get, and then when things are not going our way, then we'll turn to practice. But in fact, it's important to equanimously receive the positive stuff too, to notice the way that our mind grabs onto it and wants to make it persist forever, even while it's going on in these few seconds. And the reason that's important is because if we're not doing that, we are strengthening the habit energy of believing our thoughts are truths. And this doesn't mean we don't experience joy. And in fact, it lets us connect to a kind of joy, the kind of okayness that is present when things are well, present when things are laissez, and availably present when things are horrible. But that last part does not mean that the things that are horrible are not horrible. It doesn't mean that pain isn't painful. But when we allow that painfulness to be part of life, we are freer to move. Ezra says something important here. When our emotional distress does not feel good, we recoil from it. That's the energy of aversion. The resulting discomfort generates fear, and fear creates even more distress, and distress becomes our enemy. Distress becomes our enemy. And so what would it mean
if distress, if our distress were not the enemy, if the painfulness of life were not a problem, if suffering itself is not something to be fought and rid of, but instead something of yet another place for us to find our freedom. Often valuable, and so this not making distress into an enemy, you know, is another side of meeting ourselves, meeting our difficulties, meeting our demons as friends. When we encounter them in our zazen, as they inevitably present themselves, rather than running away from them or batting them down or concluding that their presence here is an indication of our fundamental badness or failure, to invite even our demons to share this moment, to sit with us in zazen. We can invite even our enemies to be present as not enemies. Let us instead examine our basic assumed requirement that life should be comfortable. This one assumption causes all of us endless difficulties. This is a very sharp sword, this examining this one belief, looking for this one core root belief, a belief so profound that we don't even see it as a belief and take it just as a simple fact of the matter. But looking at that and seeing that belief that life should be different, should be free from difficulties, this is a sharp sword that can cut through even in times of great pain. And this is enormously empowering. This is the gift of our practice and the gift of zazen and the gift of this precious human life in all of its ups, downs, and cycles. So I'd like to provide space for comments or questions or reactions from any of you.
final symptom of the word of the, or part of the chant that Catherine was coming up from was abiding in this kind of little, and it goes on like a lotus and blue and water. So for me, it connects with a lot of what you're talking about, and you kind of include how are we in the world, how are we in the world. And that word abiding, for me, is the sort of just really have this quality of just being held by that, including what compared to nourishing, as painful as that is, finding that there's great energy. It's just perfect. Yeah. So that's just really what's kind of to me, the sort
of. Abiding is a excellent term for this practice. Abiding. Abiding in this mess. Abiding in our lives. Abiding in this work.